You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where when the entire state is on fire, we don't save the women and children first. We don't even save the pets first, like all of you seem to want to. We save ourselves first. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and we are William Greenless this episode. He is at DEF CON with a bunch of other hackers, including nerdcore rapper YT Cracker right now in Las Vegas. But joining us this trip from our nation's capital, or capable, Daniel T. Richards.
YT Cracker, like Whitey Cracker. I get it.
It's so clever. And also, it's Cracker like he's a hacker as well, so it works on like two levels. It's probably the best nerdcore rap name out there.
YT Cracker. Awesome. Did he come out with a an album called Y2K?
He did not, but the coolest thing he did was he did a song where he sampled the Pirates of the Caribbean, however the fuck you say it, theme, and it's I Am a Pirate, except it's about how he's a hacker.
Nice. Look at that. I can appreciate good rap puns, even if I don't appreciate rap itself.
Yeah. Well, it's basically, I just like the puns of rap, and I'm willing to listen to everything else to appreciate how clever they are, so maybe I just have a higher pain threshold, which
I do. Just
give
me the puns. Just write out the puns, start a Twitter account. Write out the puns. I'll be very appreciative. What are we going to do today without someone forgoing their white male gay privilege in order to identify as a woman?
I think our ability to run this show might not be allowed anymore. I mean, I think always having the third co-host who was gay or some sort of minority made it okay for us to say all our other crap because there was representation.
Well, we can be half offensive today because I still get half minority status. Don't forget.
So basically, I'm going to be stoned now.
Yes, and not in the way that most people would like to see you stoned.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
But you know what I think most people would like? I think they would like us to just get on with it and go to the news.
Let's do it.
Let's do it in the news with Daniel T. Richards. Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
The Oscars are trying. They really are. They're trying very hard. They know that you're not on the same status you were a few years ago, you and the Oscars, so they're working on themselves. They're really trying to improve. But the way they've chosen to improve for this year has many people going, huh? What? Why? Which is mostly me in the last category. So, this is from Variety.com. For 100 years, movies have been a popular art form. So Wednesday morning, when the news came out that the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is proposing to introduce a new category at the Oscars, one that would be called Best Popular Film, the first reaction I had, apart from my jaw dropping on the floor in shock and dismay, was, Best Popular Film? What does that even mean? Of course, the article goes on to talk about the Oscar sagging ratings and the fact that it only tends to nominate movies that no one has ever seen and likely will never see, even after expanding its Best Picture category to up to 10 films. But their solution, according to the article, to add a popular film category is incoherent and essentially contradicts the nature of Oscars itself. And they ask some interesting questions, like, where would things like La La Land fall, which was a mainstream phenomenon grossing $150 million, but was certainly a well-done piece of art as opposed to popular film, which is the interesting dichotomy, perhaps false dichotomy, that this article draws. What would
false
you do
dichotomy,
with,
bro.
That's right. What would you do with The Greatest Showman on... The Greatest Showman, not The Greatest Showman on Earth, just called The Greatest Showman. And then, of course, what would you do this year with Black Panther? So, Justin, let's start there. What do you think is really up here with the Oscars and this new category they're proposing?
Well, it's the answer to the last question you ask is what would you do with Black Panther this year? Well, you would create an awards category just to give it an Academy Award. That's what you would do.
Now, that's pretty cynical, but also probably true. So go on, defend yourself.
It's 100% what it is. Black Panther, look, it's a good movie. It's one of the best Marvel movies. I've said that before. There are problems with the collectivism and the tribalism, especially at the very end in the post-credit scene, where it's like, we must all come together as one tribe and save the world. So, you know, there are problems with it. I've talked about that. But as far as a well-constructed, entertaining movie, it is a good movie. It is objectively a good movie. Now, is it as good as something like La La Land? And I'm going to use that as sort of the metric here of art that can also be entertaining, because to me, La La Land crossed both those thresholds. It's excellent art and it's entertaining. I think that's the appeal of Damien Chazelle. I think he can walk that line, which few directors can't. And you compare Black Panther to La La Land, and it isn't the same high level of art. Is it good? Is it one of the best Marvel movies? Yes. Is it as good as a Man of Steel, as a Batman versus Superman? No, because what it lacks is the depth of ideas. Now, we can get into that in a second, but what it has is exactly what Hollywood's trying to push their awards to, right? Hollywood's solution to all of these problems that the article is mentioning, that nobody wants to watch it anymore and everybody doesn't take their awards seriously anymore, is inclusion. And their inclusion is based upon diversity, not ideas, diversity of skin color, of group, of identity politics, which I believe we'll get to with the whole Jordan Peterson article we're going to talk about here in a few stories. And their solution to that is, well, we're going to give it to more minority actors. We saw it in the Golden Globes. We saw it in the Emmys. We've seen it in the Oscars. So then you're presented with a problem. When you have a movie like Black Panther, which Black Panther came out in February of this year, I believe.
Sure. No idea.
Yeah. Well, it was this year, right? It wasn't last year.
No idea. All runs okay. Together.
Christine, could you look that up? The release date of Black Panther?
Yeah, producer Christine, could you go ahead and look that up?
There you go. Producer Christine, could you Google the release date of Black Panther?
Thank you. Yes, producer Christine.
Yes, the release date of Black Panther. Thank you. I appreciate that. Because I'm going to say something that's going to favor you in a second here, is they have they have these movies now that...
February 16th of this year.
Okay. So that's going to lead into my next point. February 16th of this year, it came out. So February 16th of this year, a movie came out that answered everything Hollywood's been saying about inclusion and diversity, right? Black director, black cast, black crew members throughout. This is everything they've been saying, and it's a legitimately good movie, right? You can watch the movie and have a blind eye to race and be like, oh, this is a good movie. It legitimately does not matter what race they are. They're just from Africa, right? So what do you do when you're Hollywood and you've been virtue signaling all this crap and they make a movie that's good but not great, but everyone loves and everyone is bought into, right? Everyone was going around saying Wakanda Forever. You have to make an awards category, especially when everyone's saying you're out of touch. It's the only thing you can do from a marketing perspective. And they're walking into it again right now, and I'm going to tell you another movie that's going to be nominated for this award. Crazy Rich Asians is right now sitting at 100% on Rotten Tomatoes because it's the same thing. It's an all-Asian cast that's based on a book by an Asian author. I believe is... Christine, do you know if the director of... I'm asking my Asian girlfriend this question, by the way. Do you know if the director of Crazy Rich Asians is Asian?
Yes.
Yes, it's a woman too, right? It's an Asian woman?
It's a man.
Oh, it's a man. Okay, well, it's a man, so they failed there. Asians are still too patriarchal, but... Yeah, so that's an all-Asian cast, crew, writer as well, everything. It's sitting at 100%. Does it deserve it? I don't know any rom-com that would ever get 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, but that movie will be nominated for the best popular film as well. This is just, it's just a marketing excuse, and it's an excuse to push their agenda. That's all this category
but
is.
What is popular? What do you think that's going to mean? Is that going to be a money number? And if, for instance, Black Panther, let's say Black Panther was a good enough movie to deserve an Academy Award, can it be nominated in both categories? Can it be both a popular movie and a straight-up best film nominee? That seems strange.
They will never do that because, and this is actually something I wanted to discuss in Trailer Takedown when we talk about Jim Carrey's new series, so we'll bring this back. We have this idea in this culture that what's popular can't be art. Art must always be outside of the mainstream. Art must always be going after the system and trying to tear the system down. This is because we have this idea that naturalism is art. That is why, even though The Dark Knight was objectively the best movie the year it came out, the only award was Heath Ledger for Best Supporting Actor, and that was only because he died. Because Hollywood will never give the best film, best screenplay awards to these movies that are popular because they have this elitism. They have this idea that they are better than the mainstream and they know better than the mainstream.
But aren't they
so popular?
Yeah, but isn't that, to be a little glib here, aren't they being Trumpian about this? Aren't they setting up a sort of elites versus mainstream dichotomy just by doing this thing? By saying, here's the category for you plebs. Now the bourgeois over here, we're going to have our own category with actual art. And we'll throw you an award so that you'll keep watching. But we're going to, you know, the real awards for the real art are going to be over here. That feeds into Trump, doesn't it?
That feeds into Trump because Trump is just doing what they do. I mean, you brought it here so we can really talk about this and how this comes about. This is entirely based upon the idea that there are people who know better and they know how to run society and they know how to tell us all to live better than we all do individually. And I don't usually go in this direction, but all of you out there are going to be shocked that I'm going to name drop a philosopher and talk some philosophy. But this all goes back to the allegory of the cave, and it goes back to philosopher kings. We have people in this country who are in their ivory towers and they think they're philosopher kings and they say, we're going to run this country better. And then it's exactly what you just said. Things like welfare, things like Social Security. These are all just bones they're throwing us to make us feel better about the fact that they're engineering society by telling us, oh, well, we all need to have cars that are 50 miles per gallon by the year 2050. That's exactly what it is, and this is how it's manifesting in art. And you're 100% correct. This award is a manipulation technique.
It's Oscar entitlement program.
It's 100% what it is. That's why immediately I went to the fact that they're going to use it as basically Oscar reparations. Oh, well, we haven't given enough awards to black people, so here, we're going to give it to the black movie. Oh, and we'll nominate the Asian movie, too, because we've pissed them off recently with the college admissions crap we've been doing. That's all this is. They're the elites. They know better. They know how to make films better. This is why, ultimately, if you want to know why psychologically Zack Snyder is attacked, and you knew I had to bring it back to Zack Snyder or Tom Brady, it's the same reason Tom Brady's hated, too, actually. Ultimately, Zack Snyder is not one of the anointed. He is not one of them, and he went out there, and he made a shitload of money with 300, and then he made a great film with Man of Steel. And then he made a very subversive, amazing film with Batman versus Superman. And all of a sudden, the elites were like, wait, who the fuck is this guy? We need to look at him. And actually, that subversion began with Sucker Punch. If you look at it, it's really it's subverting all of their elitism. And if you look at Me Too, Snyder was ahead of the curve with Sucker Punch. Go back and watch that film and you realize that he was basically calling out Hollywood. But that's the point. They do these manipulation techniques to make the plebs, because that's how they see everyone, okay. Because now what's going to happen is everyone's going to celebrate. They're going to celebrate Black Panther's Oscar win. I guarantee you that's what's going to happen. But you people. Oh,
careful.
Wow. It's because I just watched Baywatch. You people. You people. That was probably the funniest line in that movie. No, you people out there, whoever celebrates the Oscar win for Black Panther, you're stupid, okay? You're contributing to your own downfall. You are letting them manipulate you. You're saying, I deserve an award, and they go, okay, we're going to create the Patsy Award, and we're going to give it to you. And you're like, oh, okay, look, they made a trophy. Hey, Mom, hey, it's like special ed on fucking Crank Acres. Mom, they gave me a trophy, Mom, they gave me a trophy. Best popular award, Wakanda forever, Wakanda forever. Like, it's just, Do you have anything to add?
Offensive on so many levels today. You take away the gay and all of a sudden the offensive floodgates just open up here.
But no, I mean, the reason I'm being this way is it's really that transparent to me that that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
It's like you want to be even more offensive. I'm going to be offensive to your half now, right? You know how they have those cliff diving kids in Mexico who, like, Americans go and, like, throw coins in the water and these kids, like, jump off of cliffs to grab the coins? Like, that is so dangerous for those kids. Like, those kids are, like, performing dolphins and seals for you that you have them, like, risk their lives to, like, get a quarter? Like, that's what this is.
I had no idea that goes on. That's funny.
They're throwing a quarter at all you fucking people when you're jumping off the cliff.
Look, I jumped off the cliff. Casa Bonita. But yeah.
Well, that's what Casa Bonita is based off of.
It's funny. Oh my. Well, what if they went just completely hypothetical here? What if they eventually see through the fact that their see-through transparent plan here is being seen through, if that's not confusing enough. And what if they go a further step here and people vote to actually nominate and award Black Panther Best Film of the Year? What then? What then, Justin?
I don't even know how that would happen because, again, like, they always complained about, like, right, like, the rich white people, like, oh, the white men who run the Republican Party, right? Oh, this that secret group of white men. It's because the Academy is literally that secret group. So the public can get up in arms all they want, but how do you infiltrate the Academy? You know, they love making these movies about, like, these secret societies that control the world. And you think in Me Too we would have learned what Harvey Weinstein did. But how do you penetrate that group? Well,
don't.
Without them forcing
don't.
You to.
Don't. But. No, I think the group, I think the Academy is going to start voting, as if they haven't already, going to start voting more and more based on social justice and not on meritocracy. And so if there's a film that they can have a veil of... not ignorance, but a veil of meritocracy, like with Black Panther, they might actually just put it in the best film category. We'll see. I'm curious.
I don't know if they can, because with all of the tribalism and collectivism in Black Panther, it is ultimately about a guy who realizes his self-worth and decides to fight for his country of Wakanda.
Well, as long as that country is not America, you think they care?
I do think they care because I think when you look at you look at last year when Moonlight won over La La Land, I think Moonlight is what they would like to see out of a picture starring a black man. It has prison, it has drugs, it has murder, it has homosexuality. I think that's what they're looking for, and I don't think Black Panther has enough of that for them to not consider it a popular film. I think to them, popular is going to mean something that's not. It doesn't push the limits. It doesn't make middle America uncomfortable. Yeah. That's ultimately what their metric is middle America uncomfortable. Look, we're not, it's not that we're uncomfortable with these things you have in the movies. You know, fine, there are gay black men. Fine, we know people deal drugs. We know people are murdered. We know all of these things happen. We know people go to prison. It's just, why do we want to watch these things?
Yeah, I actually think that, you know, the Oscars would be fine and people would watch them for even for the elitist movies, if honestly every single speech wasn't a bashing of some middle America thing. Because who wants to tune into that? Who wants to tune in and be lectured for 4 hours about how terrible you are? That's a recipe for disaster.
Well, that's their hubris, and that's why I'm saying that it's even more hubristic what they're doing. Their hubris is they're making films that say that, right? All the films they nominate are exactly what you just said. They lecture us about how bad we are. And about how we need to destroy the system because the system is oppressive towards us. And when I say system, I don't just mean the government and the culture. I mean even just the way the world is designed. And then they're so hubristic, they go up there and they make speeches about it too. And they're like, oh man, why are the ratings for the Oscars going down? We're nominating movies that say you're shit. And then in the speech, we say you're shit. And then to make us feel better, they're giving us an award that says, oh no, you're not shit. Here's your you're not shit award. I just don't know how you don't see through this.
I see it through pretty clearly, and so do you, and so do all the midsiders out there, I'm sure. But speaking of seeing through things and people who want to control what we think and do, YouTube is quote-unquote fighting back against climate misinformation and other misinformation. Basically, YouTube is now adding fact checks to videos that question climate change or vaccinations or other landing on the moon conspiracies, UFOs, Oklahoma City bombing, etc. Basically, what happens is when you visit a video like this, and the example they give is a PragerU video. This is a BuzzFeed article. PragerU video. Underneath it, a little Wikipedia entry pops up that this PragerU video is on global warming, and underneath the YouTube video, a little Wikipedia widget pops up that says global warming, also referred to as climate change, is the observed century scale in the average temperature of Earth's climate system and its related effects. Multiple lines of scientific evidence show that the climate system is warming. Basically, this is YouTube, quote-unquote, trying to fight misinformation. And it's creepy. I mean, I don't know what else to say. They're not telling people they're putting up these snippets, by the way. It's not as if they're contacting these YouTube creators and saying, hey, we're going to put up these little snippets on your videos. Nope, it's just happening. So, Justin, what do you think about this? Is this a little... I mean, it's not government, right? But it's a little creepy. It's a little, I don't know, Orwellian in a certain sense.
Well, the problem is you have these... companies, and maybe this is partially because Google bought YouTube, but they start out one way and then they pivot. YouTube was originally just about giving anyone a platform to say whatever they wanted. That's what YouTube was about. And now that they've become so popular that everyone's posting and it's the go-to place for that kind of content, they've pivoted into a content curator and a knowledge curator. So their mission, to which they invited all these people in and got all these people to go on there, is now different. So they've essentially suckered all of these people like PragerU into being on there, and now they're saying, oh no, we're something different. It'd be interesting to me if somehow this could be pushed as a false advertising or like a contractual violation lawsuit. I don't know if you could be able to do that, but that's essentially what it is.
It's a little like bit of a bait and switch.
I'm going to sell you candy, and then I start buying candy from your subscription service, and you go, oh, but every month I'm going to make sure the candy you get is healthy. And you're like, I didn't sign up for a healthy candy service.
I want candy neutrality. Yeah. So this is offensive to me on many levels. I want to be clear, though, because in the age of Donald Trump and the right calling for censoring of fake news in the news media, I think Google has every right to do this. I don't think there should be any government intervention. This is not censorship. But I do think
That's why I want the angle of they've violated their relationship with their customers.
Yeah.
They can do whatever they want. I mean, you can start making burgers and then all of a sudden start selling people shrimp, but that doesn't mean that's what you promise your customers. You have every right to do that. Go ahead, change to a shrimp shack.
I ordered a burger. This is our version of a burger. This is
exactly.
Shrimp scampi.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So my point is that this is offensive to me on a free speech level. I'm fairly much a free speech absolutist, and I think the way that you combat bad speech is with more speech. You don't try to shout down. You don't try to, deplatform people. You don't try to correct people, meaning you don't try to put like labels on their videos like this is false information, or which is essentially what Google is doing. They're putting a definition of climate change, but essentially what they're doing is what the government does with cigarette packs, which is like this thing will kill you if you smoke it. I think this is idiotic on Google's part, because the example given here, by the way, this is what's most idiotic about it. Justin, did you watch this video? Just curious. If not, that's fine. You don't need the context, but I can explain it.
I didn't watch the video, but I didn't need to watch the video because that little blurb from Wikipedia. First of all, I love the fact that we're fact checking using Wikipedia now. We're going to stop misinformation by using Wikipedia. It's the most ironic thing I've ever heard.
So but this also, video, yeah, said, go ahead.
I was going to say it also says the century. What does it say? The century scale rise in average temperature. And it says multiple lines of scientific evidence show that the climate system is warming. It's just dishonest. Look, nobody's arguing that if you look at it, over the last 100 years, the average temperature has risen 0.8 degrees. Nobody's arguing that point. The point you're arguing is the package deal that because it's getting warming, the Earth is being destroyed. So what they're doing is, by acting like they're not pushing the package deal, they're pushing the package deal. That's what's wrong with this.
Yes, totally. And what you're saying is almost exactly what the actual video is saying.
This is why this I don't guy, watch these things.
Richard Lindzen. Well, you don't watch him because you know it all.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, because I'm a fucking genius.
Thank you, Adam Carolla. Okay, Richard Lindzen is not like a right-wing pundit. He's not, you know, what's his name? Shepard Smith or Tucker Carlson or Sean Hannity. Richard Lindzen is a climate physicist and has been for more than 30 years. He's a professor at MIT who studied climate before it was cool to study climate. Like, he actually studies the climate. In an article he wrote that is not in this video, I mean, he writes that, like, in the 70s, when he was actually doing this, like, there were 30 climatologists, like, in the world. Like, there weren't many.
He was actually warming the clients? The
yes,
climate?
Indeed. They were. Him personally, outside with cans of hairspray, just spraying them into the atmosphere. No. His point is, he was actually doing this science before it was cool and mainstream, before there was a bunch of government funding for it. And this video is him explaining in the most, you know, straightforward, factual terms what the climate debate is about. And he says exactly what you said. No one is debating the fact that the climate has gotten warmer. Literally no scientist, even Richard Lindzen, who is a skeptic of catastrophic global warming, is debating the fact that things have gotten hotter. No one is debating that. Alex Epstein is not debating that. I'm not. We're not. No one is debating that. So if we could get off that train, what we're debating is, one, what is the level of human contribution to this thing? What is the level of natural contribution to this thing? And then finally, what policy points result from global warming, anthropogenic or not? Should we, for instance, as Bill Kibben suggests, abolish 98% of fossil fuels, despite the fact that that would literally, and I'm using the word literally in its literal sense, literally kill billions of human beings? Or should we do nothing? Should we allow the market to fix this problem? Or is it a problem at all? And that's what Richard Lindzen is talking about in incredibly straightforward, factual, scientific terms. And then Google comes along and says, this is fake news. Here's global warming. Wikipedia. Boom. No context, just definitions that make you think this guy must be an idiot because Google says I need to go read Wikipedia instead of watch this video. That is dishonest. It's abhorrent. And if YouTube keeps this up, they are going to lose business because of this. They're going to lose business. Not every single human being who participates in YouTube, it turns out, agrees with Google's preferred policies. And that is going to result in massive business losses in the long run. So Justin, I suggest to you that we start our own content platform that proposes and sticks to content neutrality except for actual threats of violence and fraud. Anything other than those two things, we will be content neutral. What do you say?
I say, yeah, okay, go ahead, get on that with the, I'll get on that, actually. I'll get on that with the 5 hours I have left that I sleep a night.
Awesome. Do you know who's proposing that they be the alternative to this? Have you heard this?
Vimeo?
No. Oh, no. Vimeo is way more leftist than YouTube. Pornhub.
Yeah,
I'm serious. Pornhub has actually been looking at a way to have, like, an alternative domain to their platform, but use all their sort of back-end, you know, build-out of their website and be a content-neutral video platform.
Climate physicist fucks large. Yeah, do you fill in the punchline?
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. So you're going to be giving up YouTube anytime soon?
Here's the problem when they do stuff like this is they're so ubiquitous at this point, it'd be like giving up Band-Aids, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like giving up Advil. Like, if Advil suddenly started doing stuff like this, like, how do you not, like, use it? You know what I mean? Just sometimes you have to. Like, every movie trailer is posted on YouTube. How do I not watch movie trailers?
Yeah.
Every site, it's just they're so ubiquitous.
It's got to change,
I actually have
though,
a question for you, though.
Yeah.
Usually you're the one asking the questions, but I have a question for you.
Whoa. Role reversal.
Aren't they showing their hand there? And what I'm showing their hand here. And what I mean by this is, anyone who watches the video and reads that blurb from Wikipedia is gonna, if they're smart, they're gonna say exactly what we said. Oh, well, there's nothing that in the video that is contradictory to what that blurb says. The guy agrees with that definition. So why is that there? The purpose of this then has to be to get people to not watch the video. Rhetorically, it's, this is on the video, there's something wrong with it, I'm not going to waste my time engaging with these ideas. And doesn't somebody only do that if they know that these ideas are right and their own ideas are wrong? That isn't that the only purpose of creating this kind of system? Because you know ultimately your own ideas are wrong, and this is how you shout down the other side so people don't hear the truth?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, they're so afraid of competing ideas. They are so afraid that their own ideas won't stand up in the marketplace of ideas that they have to find some ways to either outright get rid of or nudge people away from ideas that they think threaten their own. Of course, this is a long-standing issue with the left and the right, by the way, it's just that the left is so much in control of the culture that it's more prevalent. And it's going to be something that expands. Google has been fairly open, maybe in the past four-ish years, about the fact that they don't just want to be an information engine, they want to be a truth engine. They have said over and over again that eventually their algorithms will not just take into account what is popular, but what is true. And this is a step in that very frightening direction, because what is true is objective, but when you are so ideologically driven, you have no interest in that objectivity. You only have an interest in what your ideology is, and thus you will declare truth where none exists. You will declare that something is false, even if you don't understand it or it's not false, because it doesn't fit into your ideology. And that is the frightening part.
Well, remember, and again, this goes back to the previous story, actually in a very disturbing way, where what they're doing now is no different from what the Academy Awards is doing. By creating that award category, they're basically trying to shut down the movement to create popular films that are different from the naturalism that's being created. Again, that's why they're placating. It's to stop what they're afraid of, because they ultimately know what they're afraid of is better. And again, this goes back to Platonism, and this is the important thing to remember. Google, YouTube are the philosopher kings, and they want to tell us what is true. But their whole thing is, we can't really see the truth. The allegory of the cave. The allegory of the cave is everything is just shadows on the wall, so it's all how we interpret the shadows. But they believe they're the philosopher kings, who are the only ones who can see the truth. So they are never going to listen to you. They believe that your view of the world is relativistic and theirs is objective. They're the only ones who can know the objective truth.
Yeah. It's going to lead down a very weird path here, especially if conservatives or quote-unquote conservatives, Republicans, whatever, maintain control of the government, especially in the age of Trump, they're not going to be afraid to regulate Google and Facebook and Twitter and Apple, etc., if they continue down this path. Now, I don't think that's the right thing to do, but it seems to be an inevitable thing, because these platforms are predominantly targeting people who are on the quote-unquote right. And so the right is going to respond. They're not going to roll over and just let this happen to them. They're either going to go to competing platforms, or if they're in power, like Trump and his ilk, they're going to do something about it using the blunt instrument of government. That's frightening to me. I don't know about you.
It's terrifying. I don't really have anything to add to that. I mean, that's the entire system we're in right now, is they just hurl the government at each other. And it's, look, ultimately, it's against progression, and it's against freedom, and the freedom is, being against freedom is against the progression, because how do you regulate YouTube? Oh, you can only watch 5 trailers a month. Well, what the fuck 5 trailers am I going to watch? I'm just going to watch Zack Snyder trailers. I'm not going to waste my time with anything else. And that when you, especially when you start limiting speech and when you start limiting information, that's how you stop progression, because you can't be introduced to anything new. Yeah. Imagine going into the library and they said, these are the only books you can read.
Yeah.
Isn't part of the joy knowing you can go anywhere in the library and read anything and get any information?
Yeah. Good or bad, by the way. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Pick a random book off the shelf and you don't know what it's going to say, but it's going to tell you something new and you can decide for yourself whether it's good or bad. If you start regulating these platforms, that's what you're taking away.
Yeah. So for insight into, I think, what the right is generally thinking about regulation on this topic, there's a great article. By great, I mean informative. I don't necessarily, I'm not endorsing the regulatory outcome of this article, but it's called Google.gov. It's in the New Atlantis, which is a journal about technology, and it's by a lawyer named Adam J. White, and it's an eloquent article that sort of takes a look at Google's history, especially their mission statement history, and notes, for instance, which I didn't even know that Google dropped their slogan, "Don't be evil," for instance, which is weird. It's like, oh, you're pro-evil now? But he gives reasons for why they did that and why Google has become sort of governmental in its status and thus requires regulation in order to avoid antitrust issues. So Google.gov and the New Atlantis, if you want some insight, even though I don't agree with it, it's interesting.
Is that where Google is going to be hosted from now on, is Google.gov? Is that the plan?
No. That's just the name of the article, because he's trying to say that Google is like a government institution now.
I was going to say that every .gov site, you should just go to it and it should only just say two words on it. Like, get rid of everything that's on it. You go to anything.gov, and I don't literally mean anything.gov. I mean x.gov, whatever. And you go there and it just says help yourself. That's what every government website should be.
Well, I know someone who disagrees with you. And speaking of people who are afraid of things that they know to be true, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the darling of the left, the socialist who won her primary in New York, likens a $10,000 debate offer by a conservative columnist to catcalling. Yes, it was an offer she could in fact refuse, this New York Times article starts out. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a 28-year-old Democratic socialist from New York who scored a shocking primary victory over Representative Joseph Crowley in June, has since been a lightning rod for attacks from conservative circles. This is an attack, by the way, just so you know how this is framed. The conservative scrutiny on Ms. Ocasio-Cortez took a strange turn this week when a popular conservative commentator and speaker, Ben Shapiro, challenged her to debate and offered to pay her campaign $10,000 in return. Now, this article gives no context to that, but this asking for a debate comes from the fact that Ocasio-Cortez herself has said over and over again that her opponents, quote-unquote, won't debate her, despite the fact that, as far as I know, literally every right-wing and libertarian pundit, including me, would love to debate her, because she is apparently an idiot. And so Ben Shapiro basically put this out on Twitter that he would offer $10,000 to her campaign if she debated him, and this was her response. Quote, "Just like catcalling, I don't owe a response to unsolicited requests from men with bad intentions. And also like catcalling, for some reason they feel entitled to one." So Justin, is a call to debate with a $10,000 donation to your campaign much like the catcalling that you've heard in your life?
Yeah, I mean, all the catcalling I receive all the time. Yeah, I wish that I got $10,000 every time someone catcalled me, because if I did, I'd still have zero money.
I was going to say, you get a lot of catcalls at the gym and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's just that this is so revealing of just so much of the leftist psychology and the gaslighting they do. I mean, this reminds me of if anyone had the square of Justin makes a random pop punk scene reference that no one else is going to get a square and bingo. You're going to get that right now. There's a parody song maker named Jared Along, and he has a song called Trigger Warning about trying to date a feminist. And it starts out as a pop punk song, and then when the feminist he's trying to date gets pissed off, it like turns into like this hardcore like metal song where there's like lots of screaming. And what he does to piss her off is he asks a question. And then she's, how dare you how dare you doubt my feminist logic? And that's what this is she just wants to say what she wants to unquestioned. And if you ask her a question, then she flips out because it's, oh my God, you don't take me seriously. You doubt me. Now, there's some interesting questions here about feminine versus masculine and the way female self-esteem works versus male self-esteem works. Because with a guy who has good self-esteem, you ask him a question, he just answers the question and goes satisfied, and you move on. But it's with women in general, it seems to be you ask them questions sometimes and they take it personally when it's not meant to be personal, all that kind of stuff. Maybe that's a Jordan Peterson discussion. Maybe that's our last segment discussion. So there's an element of that, but feminism has made it so that's okay and that's the norm now, that you don't question them. But that's, and there's gaslighting that's as a result of that. And the gaslighting is calling you out and telling you you're the one who's wrong. Oh, you're catcalling me. You're entitled. No one's saying he's entitled to a response. If he thought he was entitled to a response, he wouldn't have offered you $10,000. And furthermore, people who catcalling aren't doing it out of entitlement. The idea that feminists have pushed that catcalling is about entitlement is gaslighting of masculinity. It's trying to tell you that masculinity at its core is negative and aggressive and entitled is what they're telling you. And it's not. When someone catcalls, they're taking a shot in the dark. They're saying, I have a right as a human being to express what I feel and what I think, and I have the right to speak that due to the First Amendment and just due to natural rights, right? The idea that as a human being, you can speak.
I'm sure the construction worker in Brooklyn often references John Locke in it to himself when he thinks about catcalling.
But my point is, that's what it is.
I think they're more Hobbesian, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, the war of every man versus every man, I mean, that might support this woman's point. But my point is, that's what it is deep down, right? They're not thinking, oh, I'm entitled to make her feel a certain way. They're looking inward, and they're saying, I want to say this, so I'm saying it. Your point of they're not thinking about John Locke actually supports me. I want to say this, so I'm saying it. That's it. And if it works out and they get a number or they get with the girl in the statistically improbable, unlikely 0.0001% that it works, then it's a bonus for them. But they're not doing it out of entitlement. Just like Ben Shapiro's not doing this out of entitlement. He goes, I'd like to debate this woman because it's good for my brand. And actually saying I want to debate this woman and offering her money is good for my brand. That's it. There's no entitlement there. He's not saying I'm entitled to a response. In fact, the fact that you don't respond helps his brand even more.
Yeah. It's ludicrous. And I think it goes to show that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is likely not the savior of the left and the new socialist movement because, and I don't plan on putting this delicately because she doesn't deserve it, she's a moron. There are incredibly smart socialists. I disagree with them, but they're insanely articulate and interesting and well-read and thoughtful. I met many of them in grad school, for instance. Ms. Cortez is not one of them. She is a complete and total idiot. And the fact that she openly says that people will not debate me even though I want to debate them, when she says, for instance, that the unemployment numbers are only down because people are taking more than one job, which is not how that's calculated, and the fact that she can't go 16 seconds without mentioning the fact that she has a degree in economics, all point to the fact that she has no real discernible intelligence, but is in fact parroting back things her Marxist professors told her in college. Everyone would love to debate her. She is essentially, and here we go, it's going to start off now, she is the Trump of the left. She is just someone who says snippets of phrases that get her base riled up, but there's no substance there. There's nothing going on behind the scenes in her head that would allow her to have any intellectual thought about something interesting or meaningful. She's a parrot. She's a parrot of bad Marxist ideology who gets people riled up who don't know any better. She is the Trump of the left. This is what we'll see more and more from the left. This is their version of Donald Trump.
This is the stupid principle Christopher Nolan talked about in the Dark Knight trilogy, where once you dress up like a bat, other people are going to start dressing up like crazy shit too. That's all that's happening now, is we're just getting crazier and crazier because Trump is in himself just a version of the left that he sold to the right, and now they're doubling down on that. So it's just, it's degradation. It's like you make a copy, and the copy gets less, the quality is less than the previous one. That's all this is.
Yeah, absolutely. So, speaking of the left, why are they so afraid?
No. I have one thing I want to say about this woman.
How dare you?
I think it's really important to point out just the psychologically unhealthy technique she uses. Look, dude, the toxic relationship I was in is exactly like this. When she says the thing, oh, no one wants to debate me. It's like when you're with a girl who's like, you never do anything I want. Then you spend an entire weekend doing what she wants, and the next week she goes, you never do what I want. She knows you're doing what she wants. She's only doing that to get you to continue to do what she wants. When she says, oh, no one wants to debate me, that's just her guilting you into voting for her. That is what she's doing.
Hmm. Interesting. So you're saying that she's a pathological liar?
Yes, 100%. 100%.
You have to be fairly pathological to get to the point where she is with what she believes, and that's unfortunate, and it's telling about... I do blame her in the sense that she's old enough to know better, but my God, the colleges don't help. What a cesspool. But speaking of colleges, and a small part that isn't a cesspool, why is the left so afraid of Jordan Peterson? That's what Caitlin Flanagan asks in an article in The Atlantic. She basically recounts a story. She says, 2 years ago, I walked downstairs and saw one of my teenage sons watching a strange YouTube video on the television. What is that? I asked. He turned to me earnestly and explained, it's a psychology professor at the University of Toronto talking about Canadian law. I figured he had finally gotten to the end of the internet, and this was the very last thing on it. She goes on to essentially say that his son is, and his friends are fairly progressive, and they voted for Hillary Clinton. They've grown up now a bit. But they are suddenly turning to Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris, Dave Rubin, Joe Rogan. And so she finally wondered what they were getting from these lectures. And it turns out that what they're getting is a rejection of identity politics. And this is something she argues that the left is not understanding about Jordan Peterson's popularity, or maybe they are and they're sort of gut reacting to it in a non-intellectual way when they're just screaming that he's a racist, misogynistic, whatever. But she contends that so many kids like hers and others in college now are getting sort of an underground education in enlightenment ideas and civil debate, and they can have conversations now about politics and policies and philosophy and art without going to the identity politics mantra. And this is what is killing the left. This is why the left, at least people who are conscious of it, not all of them are, she argues, the ones who are conscious of it, why they hate Peterson so much, because he is attacking them when they are essentially at their most vulnerable. This is what she says in conclusion. It is because the left, while it currently seems ascendant in our houses of culture and art, has in fact entered its decadent late phase, and it is deeply vulnerable. The left is afraid not of Peterson, but of the ideas he promotes, which are completely inconsistent with identity politics of any kind. She goes on to give the example of a poem in The Nation that ended up, which is a very woke poem, by the way, that ended up offending people, and the poet had to go on this apology tour, and his apology wasn't good enough because that was that was offensive as well. And she essentially says, when this kind of thing is happening, and when all of this is accepted, quote, in the houses of the holy as one of the regrettable but minor incidents that take place along the path toward greater justice, something is dying. So Justin, I ask you, is the left dying, and is that why they are lashing out at Jordan Peterson?
I'm not sure the left is dying. I wish it were true, but there is definitely an undercurrent that's larger. I didn't even mean that for you objectivists out there. There's an undercurrent that's larger than people realize against it. Right now, the silent majority is a very, very real thing. People are just letting these crazies talk because they know it's not true. Because, and this is where objectivism really hits the nail on the head, right? This is where Atlas Shrugged really gets it right, is these are not the people running this country. The people on Twitter all day being offended by everything are not the people running this country. Notice how this is mostly happening in colleges, right? That's the extreme of all of this social justice stuff that this woman is talking about. And it's the same thing with her kids, the kids she's talking about. The ones who are going to school, spending their time in their rooms doing work, are the ones who are listening to podcasts at the gym. Which, by the way, I just want to say, I appreciate the fact that somebody else listens to podcasts at the gym. I thought I was the only one, and it made me feel kind of crazy. But I'm glad to hear that. They're the ones doing that because they're the ones putting in actual work. They're the ones gaining self-esteem. And what I find is, even in California, if you feel people out.
Not up, but out.
I mean, you can get to the up later if that's what you're going for, but I usually stop it before then because, you know, when you have a relationship and everything.
Yeah.
And other things about being straight edge, I don't want to feel up random people. That'd be kind of weird. Like, hey, we get along. Let me touch your out of shape, obese body. I don't know where I'm going with this.
Harvey Lesniewski. Anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, anyone have any potted plants around? Any potted plants? I'm feeling I need to jerk off. Anyone have any potted plants?
That ficus is looking mighty nice.
That ficus is looking mighty nicus.
Oh, there you go, whitey.
So, if you feel people out and you toss a few like minor comments out there, what you'll find is most people do not agree with this stuff and they think it's absurd. You know, there's a certain level of sympathy people have where it's like, yeah, we don't want like every woman to feel like every man is Harvey Weinstein. So if that's really going on, well, of course we're going to be like, hey, don't go. Hey, stop. Hey, world, there's something wrong if you're all jerking off into ficuses in front of women. I think we can all agree with that, right, Daniel? If
that's
all men
pretty
are
universal.
Going around,
yeah.
Yeah. If all men are going around jerking off in ficuses in front of women, there's something wrong.
There are so many other plants out there, gentlemen. Rhododendra, hibiscus. That's all I know. But there are other
every
plants,
rose,
I guarantee you.
Every rose has its porn, gentlemen.
That's right. Bazinga.
I'm giving you your puns, Daniel.
Thank you.
And so people have that sympathy. But if you get past that, most people don't agree with that stuff. And they're seeing and they might have always seen or they're starting to see. I think they've always seen it. The internet as this crazy place where people say crazy things and they don't take it seriously.
Yes. But going back to Jordan Peterson specifically for a moment, I mean, I think one of the reasons it's not even necessarily the content of what Jordan Peterson says, although I do think that the left abhors, facts and absolutes and things like that. But I think it's the fact that he is one of the few people, although the movement is growing, who will not apologize for what he says if he says something that's quote-unquote offensive to them. He just will not do it, and I think that that is, one, admirable, and two, the reason why he just drives them nuts. Because the louder they demand the apology and the more he won't do it, the more incensed they're going to get and come back around and around and around until they're going to try to, you know, essentially whip him into giving them what they want, but he's not going to do it. So that drives them
Jordan
nuts.
Well, Jordan Peterson is what tenure is supposed to be, isn't he?
Yeah, essentially.
Right, where you know what's true and you've risen to this position based upon your wisdom and your intellectual ability and your ability to teach, and you have nothing to be afraid of. So you don't apologize and you just say what's true. I mean, that's why. I mean, he ultimately knows that his position is secure. I don't know if he literally has tenure, but his life is secure, right? He's worked hard enough in his life. He's succeeded enough that his self-esteem is not in jeopardy and his financial well-being is not in jeopardy. So that's why he doesn't have to apologize. And that's why they're afraid of him, because they have no leverage over him. There's nothing they can do to force him to apologize. And right. That is the greatest threat to them, is if a white man, starts doing that and inspiring other, and this is them, I'm not saying that legitimately there's actually a battle between white men and everyone else. But to them, if white men start acting in that way, that is the greatest danger to their cause and their agenda.
And a Canadian to boot, because that's got to be a real slap in the face. If a Canadian,
because he's super polite about it. That's the crazy part. Like, he's the perfect storm of like Canadian politeness and like American confidence.
Yes, because he's confident, but he's calm and reasoned and he has a good ethos, and I don't think they can stand that. They're used to the opposition being much more like Sean Hannity than Jordan Peterson. So,
Yeah, they, well, I mean, think of what they do to Trump. They want Trump to go off because then they use that against him.
Yeah.
But with Jordan Peterson, he doesn't go off, so it, they don't have anything. He doesn't add to it. And I think he knows that on some level, but on another level, I think he doesn't care. All I can think about is, imagine if Zack Snyder, after Justice League, had been like Jordan Peterson.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, going to the internet and using internet fans and start virtue signaling through the use of internet fans. Zack Snyder conceded to a certain extent. He didn't mean to. I think it was a mistake of naivete on his part, of youth on his part, because he is still a relatively young director. But if he had been like Jordan Peterson, we would have seen a much different response from Warner Brothers in regards to the Snyder Cut. Instead, who filled the... And this is everything that's wrong. If we had more people like Jordan Peterson, we'd have less people like Trump. And what I mean by that is exactly what happened to Snyder's fan base and the DC fan base. Who filled the gap, the space, as the role model for them when Snyder lowered himself and basically conceded? Trump. They basically all started acting like Trump, and they all became obnoxious about it because that's who they had as the role model for opposition. That's why you couldn't find the t-shirt that said "Make Superheroes Great Again," because that's who they saw as the only option to look towards. So yeah, they need to, ultimately, this is a long-winded way of saying this is why they need to kill Jordan Peterson, not literally, but this is why, although you never know.
Careful.
I mean, Elvis did die on the toilet. That's a little weird, right? I don't know why I just went to a conspiracy theory about Elvis dying.
With Alex Jones gone, it's time for the mid-side to fill in the conspiracy theories.
Yeah, I mean, this is why they need to end Jordan Peterson. Because if he truly inspires people like he's doing, he's got people out there reading his book. When this is, I mean, the end of the article says it, right? The best lesson Jordan Peterson gives is... What, stand tall?
Stand up straight with your shoulders back.
That's the number one thing he teaches in the beginning.
That and make your bed. So, yeah, I agree. He's a threat to all that the left has erected for themselves, and that makes him a target, unfortunately, both intellectually and physically, perhaps. But I don't know of any, you know, outright threats against him, and I hope he stays safe. I hope he's smart enough to have security at these events, especially, you know, being here in D.C. and seeing the quote-unquote Unite the Right rally and the quote-unquote Antifa rallies get violent. It's getting scarier and scarier to have what are considered oppositional views. So please stay safe, Jordan Peterson and other intellectuals out there who are not on the left. All the left ones should stay safe, too. My point is, you're not going to find midsiders out there committing acts of violence against people who disagree with them, but.
No. That's why when you say get violent, I think of midsiders who have been attacked and been the victim of acts of violence by Antifa. So getting violent, they've been violent for how long now?
I should say then the precision of language would be increasingly violent. The precise phrase.
I mean, dude. Brief tangent since you brought it up here. Warped Tour just ended for the last time ever, right? The giant scene festival that's been running for 24 years. Mm-hmm. The national tour where they would go to every city and like pop punk and emo bands and post hardcore bands would play. And the guy, Kevin Lyman, who founded it, posted all this stuff about being DIY and going out and making the world better, blah, blah, blah. And then people were replying to him about Antifa. And I literally replied to them and I was like, are you linking Antifa with punk? And they never replied to me because they knew the question was a trap. Because if they said yes, then they were letting it be known what they were thinking. And if they said no, it's like, well, why did you bring Antifa up to begin with? Which obviously it's because they're linking Antifa with punk. So even the fact that they didn't answer it shows that. What it was going on. But the fact that Antifa is being linked with that kind of stuff, and that's considered acceptable to just say out there. It's acceptable to just go on Twitter and admit you associate and like a group that covers their faces and uses violence to intimidate people?
Yeah.
That's normal?
Jordan Peterson is more punk than anyone in Antifa, just to be clear.
100%. That's a great way to end this segment. And actually, maybe we can talk about a film that's more punk than anyone in Antifa. Let's do it in The Hopeful Romantic with.
Put me into syndication. Broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made-for-TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused on
MoviePass. I say that because that's how I've been opening these segments recently. And did you see what MoviePass did now, Daniel?
What is it, down to 3 movies a month or something like that?
Not only is it down to 3 movies a month, but if you go into the app and you click on theaters, there are only certain movies you can see at certain times in those theaters. So it's not like 3 movies a month that you can see any movie at any time.
Yeah.
Or you can click on a movie and it tells you what theaters you can go to at what time. I think, this is my theory, I think that they're trying to drive traffic to certain theaters and certain movies to demonstrate how much they affect the market, to prove their company's worth.
Could be. It's interesting. I think the end result is going to be that you're going to see, and you're already seeing, like Regal has one, and now AMC has one where they have their own plans that you subscribe to for $10 a month, and you get to see unlimited movies at their theaters. I think that's going to be the model that's successful. FISA, who was a early adopter of MoviePass back when it was $50 a month, which she got every bit of value out of back in LA, I think she's going to move to the AMC Stubs. It's like it's called like the Stubs Advanced Program or something, where it's $10 a month and you can see as many movies as you want at AMC theaters. So, I don't know. It was a good idea.
Well, it was a good idea, especially if AMC and Regal start doing it.
Yeah, they both have it already. They're just trying to sign people up now. So,
I didn't know that. If that's the case, then Christine, we got to talk about this. I'm probably going to cancel MoviePass and do that immediately. Because my problem is, and this is going to segue into the review, is I still have not fucking seen Skyscraper because these people won't let me see it now. I signed the app, no showings of Skyscraper anywhere.
And there's no way to see it otherwise, so.
Well, I didn't want to pay more money.
I know. I'm giving you a hard time.
So you know what I watched instead? I watched another rock action movie.
You watched King Kong versus Mega Dinosaur, or whatever that movie was?
The Meg? You know, Christine was looking at the MoviePass app yesterday, and she was like, they're showing every place you can see some... You can see, first of all, you can see Slender Man. I was like, fuck no. Fuck that. You can see Slender Man. And then I explained it to her, and she goes, wait, wasn't Slender Man like that meme that like made these two girls kill her classmate? I was like, yeah, that's the plot of the movie. She's like, they made a fucking movie about that? I was like, yes, welcome to America in 2018.
No, I was talking about Rampage. That's what I was thinking of.
Oh, yeah. I thought you were talking about The Meg, which was the other one the apps were showing. I was like, yeah, let's go see The Meg.
That's the Meg Ryan story.
Yes, it's about Jason Statham hunting a giant Meg Ryan.
Hmm. Very postmodern. I like it.
Yeah. No. I have seen Rampage. I've also seen that. No, I saw Baywatch. I went back on Amazon Prime and I was like, oh, Baywatch. Yeah, let's watch that. I haven't seen that movie starring The Rock.
Because everything old is new again.
Yeah, okay, if anyone heard that, Christine was the one who found it. If you know, go listen to the recent Adam and Drew show where he talks about how comedy isn't real. And you embellish and you change facts to make it funnier. It's not funny if I say, hey, I made my Asian girlfriend look at what's on Amazon Prime and tell me what's worth seeing. Then I just come across like a dick.
Yeah, it's a little funny.
Why do you say Asian?
And she obediently did it.
Okay, funny. Because of what it was, what Dan just said. She's arguing me as to why I said to say Asian. It's what Dan just said. Dan just said, "Oh, she did it obediently." That was the joke. God, I can explain comedy on my podcast. Can you imagine if I did stand up and she was in the audience? Like, why'd you say Asian in that joke?
Yeah, you're certainly not dating Ali Wong. So,
Can you? Like, Ali Wong, like, she gets, like, immediately pregnant after. Like, she's, like, the most fertile woman I've ever seen in my entire life. Like, every stand-up special she does, she's pregnant in.
Yeah, two for two.
It's insane. It's like, she must get pregnant immediately after she gives birth.
Yeah, you stand too close to Ali Wong.
Yeah. You and your wife have to leave the hospital before you fuck again? I just figured we'd do it all here.
That would not be pleasant. That would not be pleasant. Okay, Baywatch.
Well, that's how interesting Baywatch was. Okay, look. Here's the thing about Baywatch. If you ever need an example of how a director makes or breaks a movie, it is Baywatch. The script is decent. There's one major issue with the script, which I'll get to in a second. But Baywatch is terribly directed. All of it is, the actors have no direction. They're just basically playing themselves. It was just Zac Efron and The Rock delivering lines. And then all of the framing is like one shot and two shots like television. It's the thing I always complain about. I'm so sick of this uncreated style of directing where it's just one shots and two shots of people talking. It's a motion picture. It's a movie. It's not a play. You're not filming a play. Stop it. That is the major problem with this movie. It's just visually, it's completely boring and uninteresting. They didn't think of anything interesting to do with this movie.
Coming soon, Baywatch the Play by David Mamet.
That would be more entertaining. I would watch that. Especially if they focused on the dual relationship between The Rock as Mitch and David Hasselhoff as Mitch. That was the funniest scene in the movie, where David Hasselhoff shows up as Mitch.
Yeah.
And he's like, hey, Mitch, wait, why am I Mitch? Like, it was just funny that they hung a lantern on that. That was funny. But the biggest problem with the script for me was the way it pivoted. They go through the whole story is about how there's this drug. And I don't know if you guys hear my cat in the background, but
podcat.
The podcat is going really crazy today. So there's this drug, this underground drug ring in the bay. Pelican Bay, White Pine Bay. I don't know. White Pine Bay was Bates Motel, wasn't it? I don't know. Whatever. So in some bay that they're watching, there's an underground drug ring. And in order to get rid of Mitch, who's played by The Rock, if you didn't know, people who never watch Baywatch, Mitch is the name of the lead lifeguard, who's like super moral and super awesome. And to get rid of him, they bring in Zac Efron, who's a gold medalist who basically is like a fuck up, right? He's what you would think of like a celebrity nowadays who becomes famous and then is a total fuck up. And they bring him in to the plan is to use him to oust Mitch. And then he's not really going to want to, you know, uphold the law the way Mitch does, because Mitch, you know, even though he's the lifeguard, is basically the police and the moral compass of this entire bay. So that's the entire plot. And in it, it's about the relationship between The Rock and Zac Efron. Zac Efron is obviously the Olympic swimmer. And the entire first half of the movie is about how Zac Efron is just this fuck up and won't take things seriously. Until a certain point where he realizes he messed up, and then he says, I'm sorry. And then all of a sudden, him and The Rock are partners. So the first half of the movie is them hazing him, The Rock and his crew hazing Zac Efron and hating him, hazing and hating. And then he says, I'm sorry, and everything's okay all of a sudden. So the character development is just wonky in the movie. But if you can look all past all that, I enjoyed it.
So, surprisingly, I've seen this movie, which is weird if you know literally anything about me, but you might imagine it's because my wife saw this movie and she wanted me to see it, so we saw it. My review of this movie in its entirety is I laughed. That's it. There's no substance really to this movie. It's just some jokes and it's fun and that's it. And it's not going to win Academy Award. It won't even be nominated for popular movie, but I laughed. And if you want to laugh, you should watch the movie. That's it.
Yeah, it has some good running bits in it. I think my favorite running bit is how The Rock always has different, like, young boy band names or young male actor names for Zac Efron as a nickname, and at what point he calls Zac Efron High School Musical.
Yep.
I thought that was pretty good. That's what I mean. The script writing is witty. It's there's some good stuff in there.
Totally.
All right, let's move forward here. We're going to talk about some trailers, and as always, if you want to see the trailers before we talk about them, you can find them on themidside.com/podcast. I post them every Thursday. You can see the trailer takedown preview. You could pause the episode now and do it. You could do it before you start the episode. You could do it as we watch as we talk about the different trailers. You can pause when trailer takedown Dan goes, second trailer. This is why he does it and I don't. Because I have a weird, like, Sean Connery impersonation or something when I do that. When he says that, you can hit pause and then watch the second trailer. But again, the trailers are on themidside.com/podcast.
Trailer takedown. First trailer.
Kidding is the inevitable Jim Carrey television show, because every actor is doing a television show nowadays. In it, he acts as a sort of Mr. Rogers-type character, where he is the only good person in a really dark, messed up world. It's sort of like the reversed Breaking Bad in a way. My problem with this entire trailer is exactly what I was talking about in the opening. Is it's this idea that to make good art, it must be naturalistic. Why anyone thought of the idea would be, well, I know the answer, but to put a good person in a terrible world and slowly break him down and make him hate himself or hate the world would be entertaining is beyond me. And I say that because it's beyond me in a sense of life way, but it's not beyond me in an intellectual way. They're doing this because this is the way they believe the world is and they believe life is. So they have to teach us this and make us feel that this is the experience of the world. They want us to watch this and go, oh yeah, that's life. That's how I see life. So for me, this is a pretty hard tackle.
How are they going to sustain this as a television show? I thought that maybe on the outside, this might have some merit as a movie. But how do you do this for 10 episodes or 13 episodes or, God forbid, 20 episodes or something like that? It just seems like it would just be like self-flagellation for hours on end. No, I will not watch this remake of Death to Smoochie. Tackle.
But Death to Smoochie had more redeeming value than this did. There was actually a point to it, and it wasn't purely naturalistic.
It at least didn't take itself this seriously. I'll give you that. I'm not going to go as far as say there's a point.
Now I'm going to pop in my Death to Smoochie DVD and rewatch it. That was a deep pull. That was from high school. Ed Norton.
Ed Norton, thank you. Jim Norton.
And Robin Williams.
The horrible comedian, yeah.
The fact that I know who's in the movie, this is how much useless information I have in my brain, Midsiders. He said Death to Smoochie, I can picture the cover of the DVD and I know who's in it.
Danny DeVito, also in it.
Terrifying. Yeah. Terrifying. The movie's not terrifying. The fact that I know these things is terrifying.
Who's the Secretary of State?
Who's the Secretary of State? Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton.
Next trailer.
No, you say a series, you say 20 episodes. Yo, how could this go for like 5 seasons? Can you imagine 5 seasons of like Jim Carrey being made to feel like shit?
No, I can't. I don't. I can't do it. Hard tackle.
Second trailer.
Maniac is probably Netflix's most expensive series ever because it stars Academy Award winner Emma Stone and Academy Award nominee Jonah Hill. It's basically a series-long episode of Black Mirror. So the two of them are subjects in a drug trial, some sort of scientific trial about getting their mind right. And the scientist seems to be saying that you can manipulate the mind to change almost anything, which is actually, it made me think of Split. Where in Split, it talks about how the different personalities can actually manifest the body differently physically. So there were some similarities there as well. The thing I liked about this trailer is when I read about this series and I started watching the trailer, I had this idea that it was going to be really terrible, dark naturalism. But as the trailer went on, as I said, it really reminded me of an episode of Black Mirror. Like, it was science fiction. It was science fiction about what was possible and the pitfalls that are possibly out there. And specifically, when the trailer got to the scene where it was everyone sitting in that one room together, I saw that the directing was more than pure naturalism, that it wasn't naturalism at all. And that shifted my entire perception of this. And once it did that, I was like, I am in. I am in for the sequel to Superbad. Hug.
Hug.
This is a total recall for the Stranger Things generation. At least that's what it reminded me of. Maybe. I think what I will do is I will give this an episode or two, since it won't cost me anything more since it's on Netflix. So this is a very, very, very tentative hug for this show.
Hug?
And that's all I have to say about that.
It's a good description, but you know what? Total recall for the Stranger Things generation? I'm here for it, especially if it stars Emma Stone and Jonah Hill.
Third trailer.
Disenchanted is another Netflix series, and it's basically Shrek the Animated Series, if done by Matt Groening. So this princess goes to marry... What? Did I say his name wrong?
I think so. Well, I don't know. It's either Groening or Groening, but I have no idea.
Groening?
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 Groaning?
Groaning?
Man getting hit by football over and over again?
All right, go on.
Hans Moleman. Hans Moleman. That's an MC Lars reference. So I've referenced Whitey Cracker and MC Lars on this podcast. Wow. Anyway, so this princess goes to marry some dude, I guess as a king. I don't know. It's unclear. But she realizes she doesn't want to. He accidentally dies. And then she goes and experiences her freedom. And it's basically about her adolescence from that point on. So there's like, again, it's sort of like Futurama, but sort of like The Simpsons. It's like a crossover between the two. Because of those two comparisons, which are also both done by Matt, whatever his last name is, I'm hesitant. Because I really like Futurama. It doesn't go into the leftist approaches that The Simpsons does. But although, I'm hesitant because I'm not a big fan of The Simpsons for that reason. So if Daniel tells me this is good, then it's a hug. Otherwise, it's a tackle.
Tackle!
Because you know I'm going to watch it. Don't bury the lead. Hug. Futurama was awesome. This is sort of like Futurama meets Game of Thrones. You know, The Simpsons culturally has always been left. But that being said, I don't know, Justin, in the last season alone, I think the culture has moved so radically to the left that The Simpsons is left in this strange middle or rational left, like Dave Rubin-esque area. The episodes they did, like lambasting college campuses, specifically Yale, and then lambasting the outcry over Apu, like, really had me applauding The Simpsons. So it may be time to check back in for you on The Simpsons and see where things are. So,
Well, here, send me the Apu one and I'll watch it. That interests me. Okay. Because that controversy was absurd.
Yeah. They panned over to a picture of Apu after this. I won't give away the whole scene, but the sort of end of it is they pan over to this picture of Apu, which is signed "Don't Have a Cow Man" on it, which I thought was really effing funny.
That's funny. So it's not a whole episode about Apu?
Well, the whole episode is about social justice in a certain sense, but that specific scene is about Apu.
Okay, well, send me that episode.
But the whole episode is about literature and sort of like literature that used to be acceptable, which is now no longer acceptable.
Yeah, you mean like Huck Finn?
Yeah, it's basically... It's not Huck Finn, it's like Jane Eyre or something, but that's the, yeah, anyway.
Last Simpsons I saw was the Patriots one.
Yeah, well, you should also watch the one on Yale, which is really funny, too.
Okay, send me those two episodes.
Okay, I will. Anyway, I'm a hug. I like this style, I like Matt Groening, I love Futurama, I will still go back occasionally and watch episodes of Futurama if nothing else interests me because it's so good, so... Hug?
Hug. Final trailer.
The Nutcracker and the Four Realms is Disney's inevitable reboot, live action, reboot, or is there a Nutcracker movie before? I don't know. Then I know the Nutcracker as a play, but it's Disney's version of that, sort of in the vein of like Maleficent and things like that, which they actually put on there, like from the producers of Beauty and the Beast and Maleficent, which is like, I don't understand that, Daniel. Like, if it's by Disney, do you really need to put on like from the producers of Maleficent and Beauty and the Beast? Or are we saying it's from those producers inside of Disney?
I think it's from those specific producers who did those things. Because otherwise, wouldn't you just leave it like from the producers of Star Wars?
Well, that's what I mean. Like, why doesn't every Disney movie start with that? From the producers of Star Wars and the Avengers comes
Mr. Whatever this crap film is.
Yeah, exactly. We both could not think of a punchline to that setup. Okay, here's the thing. I initially, anyone who follows us knows that Disenchanted was not originally on Trailer Takedown. I had forgotten to put it on there. And once I realized that, I was considering cutting the Nutcracker trailer. But I kept it for one specific reason. And this specific reason is actually turning this into a hug.
Oh.
Daniel, I got Sucker Punch vibes from this movie.
What?
Even down to the use of music, the remix of Just a Girl. I swear to God, somebody watched Sucker Punch and was like, why don't we do a movie in this style? So I'm going to see this just because I want to see what they do with it. That's all. Plus, then they were like, there are multiple realms and like, we're going to deal with the realms. And I was like, yes, done.
Hug.
I'm Matt groaning right now.
Matt groaning?
Matt graining? Greening? Okay. This is terrible. It's total crap. The Nutcracker is not a play. It is a ballet. And we're talking about the degradation of culture, you and I, the other day. Go see the ballet.
Wait. Is it a ballet, a play where people dance?
No, because there's no talking or singing. It's just dancing with music.
So isn't there like a giant rat in the Nutcracker ballet?
Yes.
So indeed. The Rat King dances and doesn't say anything?
Correct. No one speaks. It's just music.
It seems like a waste of a giant rat.
It's fantastic. Go see it. Done by a professional ballet company. It plays every year on the Christmas time in every major city. You can get tickets. I guarantee it. And it will be a million times better than whatever the hell this trailer was. Hard tackle.
Tackle.
You could see the ballet, or you could see the Disney Sucker Punch bastardized version of the Nutcracker.
I feel this trailer could have been called Our Pleasure Centers Have Been Burned Out, the movie. That's what it felt like to me.
You didn't pick up the remix of Just a Girl by No Doubt in there?
I don't even know what those things... I don't know what those things are that you just said. I vaguely know what a remix is. Other than that, I have doubts, to be clear. Justin?
I was making things super uncomfortable for you because you do not know who No Doubt is or the song Just a Girl.
And I was like, oh, then my phone died or something. I guess the podcast is done.
All right. Well, when we're saying Just a Girl, that song is very much about like female empowerment and not seeing it as someone as just a girl, which is now you see why it's in that trailer. There's something I want to talk about in our final segment here of Life on the Midside. So Daniel. Since there's only the two of us, I feel the urge to start every segment with that, by the way. I had to, like, I almost started the last segment with that, but I decided not to because I was like, if I start every segment with that, that's terrible. I have something I want to bring up, and William, he actually had something he wanted to say about this, so we'll quote him in a second. And this goes back to the Jordan Peterson discussion and actually some of the discussions earlier in the episode as well, and why people are so threatened by his confidence. You know, I said that they're worried that if white men start feeling this way, that it's going to create a problem for them. And that's because I've noticed something. I've noticed that our culture has become increasingly feminized. Now, this is something we've talked about on the show before, but for me, it's become nearly impossible to escape where no matter what you do, the way you get responses back is very feminine. And what I mean by that is it's reactionary and it's emotional based. There's no constructive criticism in the sense that people sit down and they think about things and they think about a way to handle things that just tells you the things that are wrong and how to take care of them. It's just like, these are all the things that I'm immediately noticing are wrong or that I'm feeling are wrong. Or things are about taste now rather than what is objectively true or not. More time is spent in the margins of, oh, let's make things more to my taste than make them do what they're supposed to do. So when you're designing, for instance, in my type of job, when you're designing a presentation, it becomes less about making sure the correct information is in there and it's presented in a way that's understandable, but it's the way it's presented is appealing to the person in power's taste.
So why don't
my question is...
Go ahead. You have a question. Fine.
Well, my question is just how do we deal with this as guys? We're living in an increasingly feminized world. How do we deal with that?
All right. Well, I'll throw back some questions at you. You can percolate and then I'll respond. How about that? So my questions to throw back at you before I answer are, why don't you give, or can you give some more insight into why these things are feminine? Because the sort of corresponding question to me is, do you have issue with putting emotion purely in the realm of feminine and reason purely in the realm of masculine? Now, all those things being said, I think what you're identifying is totally true no matter what we call it, whether it's feminization of the culture, whether it's emotionalization of the culture, whatever it is. What you're experiencing is 100% correct, and I experience it all the time. I think one of the ways that I deal with it is to make people give reasons for what it is that they want to do, whether this is at work or otherwise, and people suggest a change or suggest something, I'll say, well, why do you want to do that? And I have on numerous occasions when they've said like, well, I don't like this or I don't like that, say, well, that's not a reason. That's a feeling. What are your reasons for wanting to do this? And sometimes that disarms them as long as you do it in a way that's totally not, dickish. Speaking of masculine, which I try not to be. I try to be very empathetic about it. But the point is, I want people to give me reasons for why we do things. I don't want it to simply be, I would prefer it another way, and you know, we're not just picking out ice cream flavors, we're actually doing work. So that's one of the ways I deal with it. Another way I deal with it is just simply to, as much as I can, do my own thing. And work while working on teams is one thing, delegating and allowing people to do whatever it is they're going to do, as long as they do it within the realm of what's acceptable, then fine, let's move on so that we don't have to have these confrontations all the time. So that's just a couple ways. So now your thoughts on everything I said and my questions. Go.
Well, my initial response to what you said is, if your solution is to be more independent and spend more time on my own, what the fuck, dude? I'm going to go buy a cabin somewhere and live in the forest and then it's going to burn down?
Yeah, be a little more Nick Offerman, will you? Make a canoe and then paddle it up the river and then...
That's my first response. And in regards to the other thing, you're raising interesting points, and I think we're going to have to talk this out a little bit, because I have an initial thought, and I think you're going to be able to refine it a little bit better. Okay. So the first thing is, no, I would never say that emotions and reason are just purely masculine or purely feminine. I wouldn't say that. So emotions are not purely the realm of women, but it's how women deal with emotions. And that's the thought I wanted to have you refine a little bit. I think women are more reactionary with their emotions than men are. And I think even in myself, I think the bad habits I've learned of being reactionary with my emotions, I learned from my mother, because my dad was sort of more removed than my mother was as far as raising me. Not that he wasn't in my life, but he sort of let my mom handle the day-to-day stuff, and he certainly didn't talk to me about feelings, or like the only ideas he ever gave me were think for yourself and do what makes you happy. So that's where my individualism comes from. But that's sort of the way I think about it, is that women are more reactionary with it. And I also think they place a greater emphasis on how things feel, where I think as guys are more pragmatic problem solvers, where it would be okay, you know, I feel a certain way about this, but it doesn't matter how I feel. Like, we just got to get this done. Let's get this done and out the door. But women are less likely to want to get things out the door if they don't feel good about it as well.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I think that's a better way of looking at it than, you know, the emotion reason dichotomy. It's the response to emotion or the response to reason. And Zadam Carolla, to bring him up yet again, once said, you know, if women had more weight, like if they were bigger than men, that we'd probably be beaten to death, men as a collective unit. Because, like, if you, you know, if you step on a woman's toe, for instance, her first reaction is to, you know, smack you in the arm or whatever it is, whereas that is not a man's first reaction. Or if it is, it's stifled. And so, yeah, there is
First reaction? When someone steps on your toe or does something like that, what's your first reaction? Because mine is, and I think this is a very typical male response, mine is like, why the fuck did you do that? That's my first response.
Yeah, very much. Like, hey, watch it. You know, that kind of thing.
It's like, I'm fucking here right now. Like, I'm here. That's my first response. Why would you do that? Don't you see someone walking?
Yeah. Whereas my wife and other women that I've seen, the first reaction is to, like, reach out and smack, which is a version of I'm here, by the way. Just a much more visceral, tied to your emotion. Like, it's more that your response is immediately tied to your emotion, and is more readily available to your emotion, which is interesting, because mine is not.
Well, and that's exactly what I'm saying. Exactly what you just said is the way I find that work is with people, and even outside of work, that people's reactions are much more tied to their emotions now than they are to the situation. Like, when something happens in public, and it happens to me, I'm much more tied to the situation, and other people are much more tied to their emotions. I mean, this goes to the narcissism I always talk about.
Yeah. So, it's interesting. So, do you have any techniques for dealing with it?
No, that's why I asked, because my techniques for dealing with it are to get super frustrated and be like, why does this always happen? I can't deal with this. Fuck everyone. And then I go to the gym. So really, it's I go to the gym. That's my way of dealing with this.
Ah, yes.
Because to me, the gym is, like, ironically, it's my safe space, right? It's the one place where I can just, like, be a guy. I can go, I can be purely physical, or, you know, I can listen to Adam and Dr. Drew. That's the podcast I listen to at the gym. And no one can stop me. There's nothing they can do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Well, if any midsiders out there have techniques, or if you disagree with us, or if you agree with us but for different reasons, let us know all over social media at the midside. We'd be interested to hear from you.
William said, this is what he said in Discord. We have a special show prep channel that you all can't get into. And he said that, I wanted to say on Life on the Midside section that supporting other males to speak their concerns is increasingly important. Their concerns are always met with stop minimizing and man up. So I think that's an interesting idea. It's that the long-term approach needs to be sort of, and this is how I'm interpreting it. So William, if I'm wrong, you can tell me next week. The long-term approach that men have, or the less reactionary approach, needs to be raised up as equally valid now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there are other ways that this manifests that we can talk about in the future, like in managerial technique and style, and employee technique and style, and project management technique, etc. But for another time.
Well, yeah, and just one final thought, everything you're saying. I mean, I think maybe just the Jordan Peterson thing, and what I'm saying earlier is this speaks directly to my experience, where ironically, my experience of immediately getting frustrated and having all these reactions is the more reactionary emotional style that I learned from my mother. I could stand to be a little bit more like Jordan Peterson and just be completely calm about it and be like, this is just the way it is. This is just the way they are. And it's not the way I am.
Yeah.
Well, that leads into the next segment. You guys know what I'm going to say as we close out here. What did you learn this trip, Daniel?
Well, I learned that catcalling in New York must be very oddly intellectual. So, never thought that. But
like, truly, people from Brooklyn, not hipsters, are oddly intellectual. Like, you think they're the way you just said they are, but then you actually talk to them, and you're like, wow, you actually know more than you're fucking letting on there.
Yeah. Citing Rousseau and Locke and all the Enlightenment philosophers. Yeah, what did you learn this week?
You say Russo in Brooklyn, and they're going to think you mean Vince Russo, the guy who used to book professional wrestling.
Sure. More references. I have no idea what you're talking about.
No, I mean, I learned that, you know, just to be more like Jordan Peterson, or to be more general, just to enjoy the things I enjoy more. Maybe I'm going more towards professional wrestling and appreciating things like that more, and talking about The Rock more and watching those type of movies, just because maybe psychologically that's just where I feel the most safety and comfort right now in our society. Something to watch going forward.
Well, we hope you learned something here at The Midside this week. Thanks for joining us. If you did, why don't you tell us on the social medias at The Midside? Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, Vero. Anywhere where social media is, The Midside is there too. You can go to themidside.com/podcast and listen to all the previous episodes of the show going way back, way, way back. And also including things like the Snyder series and the Nolan notes and any number of special edition shows that we did way back when, including last year's episodes of Belichick Your Premises. Football season's coming up. Jess and I have to discuss what the hell we're going to do there, if we're going to do another season or not. Let us know what you think about that on all the social medias at The Midside if you'd like to hear more rational sports talk. You can also go to themidside.com/store if you want to pick up a False Dichotomy Bro shirt, or a Hail Snyder shirt, or a classic Midside logo tee. Wear that around with pride, my friends. When you want to get the episode delivered to you the moment it's published, you need to make sure that you're subscribed on either iTunes or Google Play. While you're there, and you're just typing in The Midside to find us, leave us a 5-star review. Helps us raise through the ranks, helps us take over the podcasting world. Our goal, I think, long-term, is when The Atlantic is writing an article about how hated Jordan Peterson is, among the podcasts that the writer's son listens to, we'd like to be listed in that comma series right there. So, Dave Rubin, Sam Harris, The Midside, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's the goal, my friend. So, another way you can accomplish that is by telling a friend about the show. Telling a friend is the number one way that your friends know about the show. It's true! Scientifically proven, 4 out of 5 dentists agree that you should tell your friends about this show. And then if you really want to support the show, even though telling a friend is super supportive, you can also support us financially on patreon.com/themidside. It helps us keep the lights on. It helps us keep the hosting on, which is actually more important than the lights, come to think of it. I can do the show in the dark, but we can't do it without hosting. And when you're at Patreon, you can choose to give a couple bucks an episode. So every time we produce a piece of content, you get charged. No content, no money. That's how that works. So we really appreciate everyone tuning in. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us. And until next time, we love you lots.
This concludes your journey into The Midside. I'm Justin M. Wisniewski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day. There's a great dad joke that I heard this week, Justin, which is this. You want to hear this word I just made up?
Sure.
Plagiarism.